everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Sediment. We are live in Denver, Colorado. We're recording episode 2, which is day 2 of ASPN programming. We have had a wonderful day of programming. We've had several Jedi sessions. We've learned amazing new science in nephrotic syndrome, hypertension, and transplant. Now, your hosts for today, Stella Shin and Sudha M., we'll ask the chairs of these wonderful sessions about how it all went and what we've discovered. But first, introductions. My name is Sudha Garimella, and I'm a pediatric nephrologist in sunny South Carolina, Greenville. A fun fact about me is I first entered the world of Twitter at ASPN annual meeting in 2014. My first tweet was from the conference. If I can do it at my age, anyone can. So, I also have a personal milestone to share. My firstborn child will enter college this fall. I'm very proud of him. He's going to be starting at Georgia Tech, studying computer science. So go Yellow Jackets, I guess. They're very adorable and very honest about their talents in sports. But I hear they're super in computer science, so we'll go with that. All right, without further ado, your hosts will take over.
Hi, my name is Sudha Manemudu. I'm the other Sudha. I am a pediatric nephrologist and clinical assistant professor at East Tennessee Children's Hospital and University of Tennessee at Knoxville. A fun fact about me is I am a classical dancer, not a ballroom dancer. I am a classical dancer.
Hi, my name is Stella Shin. I'm a pediatric nephrologist in Atlanta. I'm back today as a host, not a guest. And a fun fact about me relates to my fun fact from yesterday, which is that my husband claims my superpower is that I know the lyrics to almost every song. And that is the last fun fact that I have, so I will not be appearing on this podcast anymore.
Let's talk to our first guest, Andrew.
Hello, everyone. I'm Andrew South, associate professor at Wake Forest and Brainerd Children's Hospital in North Carolina. Gosh, fun fact about me this time around. Continuing the theme of trying to learn random things that are fun, I know how to crochet.
Thank you, Andrew. Now, Patty C. O'Meyer.
Yeah, hi, I'm Patty C. O'Meyer, and I am an associate professor at the University of Virginia, but I do my clinical work at Inova Children's Hospital in Northern Virginia. My fun fact is that I come from all of my children play soccer, so I decided in my elderly state to join an over 40 women's soccer team. And my nickname is Peanut, P-E-E-N-U-T. Because I'm petite and also, you know, what I do for a living. And so I get a lot of good laughs about that. And I have broken my leg only once, but I'm still continuing to play. So hopefully I will be able to transition to the over 50 league in a couple of years successfully.
Mm-hmm. Next, we have Linda Soon.
My name is Linda Soon. Very glad to be here tonight. I'm a pediatric nephrologist and assistant professor of pediatrics from University of Iowa Children's Hospital. So one of the fun fact about me is I'm a big fan of watercolor painting. It started from my PQ rotation as a resident. Really sort of a very good way to rewind yourself, so I recommend to everybody. So in Iowa City, the summer is really beautiful and green. So if you come by and visit Iowa, and you will just have this kind of desire to paint something.
Yeah, I'm gonna have a request. So we have this art in nephrology session for kidney notes. Please submit your pictures.
Oh yeah. I'll be so happy to look into what you guys have already collected.
Our latest guest is Elizabeth Spivak.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Spivak. I'm a pediatric nephrologist at Peyton Manning Children's Hospital in Indianapolis, Indiana. And my fun fact is I just became a foster mom. I took boards on March 30th, and I got my first foster placement on April 4th. So I am throwing myself into the fire of being a foster mom.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So first on our agenda today, we'd like to talk about the inaugural Schnapper Lecture on updates in nephrotic syndrome. So, Linda, I'd like to ask, what was your overall impression of the series today?
So this is a really wonderful session. We had a lot of audience, and we had four distinguished speakers who discussed a pretty broad spectrum of nephrotic syndrome, from evidence-based best practice for the management of steroid-sensitive, dependent, and resistant nephrotic syndrome, and to the basic science of podocytopathy, and also new techniques and new models to study podocyte science. And lastly, one of my favorite topic, the last session was about post-transplant recurrence of nephrotic syndrome. So seems like they cover different aspects of nephrotic syndrome, but actually they are connected together. I told one of our speakers that like circulating factors brought us together.
I like that.
One of the things that really struck me about that session is when Dr. Gibson presented about how there are no differences in relapse rates between 8 and 12 weeks of steroids. And I feel like a lot of us still practice following the old guidelines of 12 weeks. Do you see that changing in the future?
To be honest, I feel that's, I remember last time when we went to the ASN of last year, there was a publication about also clinical trial. They compared the 12 weeks versus 8 weeks of induction therapy. Actually, that conclusion was prefer 12 weeks of induction therapy. And I know in our university, because you want to give them the best induction therapy, a lot of people still tend to use a longer induction to reduce the recurrence. But I'm so glad to hear Dr. Gibson mentioned, you know, a lot of families' opinion. Their opinion counts as well. So they really want to minimize the side effects, and especially if it is a recurrent patient, you want to minimize the overall exposure to steroid. I personally vote for 8 weeks, but certainly welcome to give me your opinion.
Mm-hmm. You make such a good point about the family opinions, because it's really important. You know, if they don't like the side effects, they're not going to take the medications, and if they don't take the medications, how are you going to treat the patient? So exactly. It's a very important point. I agree with that.
Yeah. In that, if I could add one, I have like many teenagers who say that I have to tell them like, it's not going to be this long next time. It's only this time. So that makes them a little bit feel better, I guess, and accept the treatment.
Yes, especially I remember some of the teenagers, they came back with acne's and mm-hmm. also like string streaks. So I just try to encourage them, say, eventually everything will just go back to normal, hopefully.
The stretch marks.
Yes.
One of the other talks that I found interesting was the last one that you brought up about transplant recurrence and specific HLA haplotype risk factors. It made me wonder if that's something that we should start doing routinely, looking at the HLA risk pre-transplant.
Yeah, that's a good point. To be honest, that I haven't looked into all those data yet, but I think those data potentially are available because they do tissue typing. They should already have those specimens available. So it's just in terms of how we group together to propose this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
It's so nerve-wracking when you are trying to plan a transplant for somebody with FSGS because you don't know if they're going to recur or not. If we had that information in advance, we could save a lot of unnecessary treatments, plasmapheresis, rituximab.
Exactly.
Yeah, so
yeah,
it would be
probably
really
like a better allocation of the allograft to somebody who actually is a better match. Good point.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, I'm going to jump in and ask you, we felt like listening to Dr. Gibson's talk that all roads lead to rituximab. Like, no matter what the underlying etiology of nephrotic is, let's throw some rituximab at it. So what do you feel? Because when we first started using rituximab, I remember that as a community, we were all very nervous about the side effects. But now it feels like we use it like water. So are we not seeing these scary side effects anymore, or have we become immune to like the risk?
So that's a very good question. I think the regimen might be a little bit different. Initially, when I first tried to use that in my fellowship, although obviously under the guidance of my attending, we used like four doses, like a more rheumatology type of regimen. I did see sort of 6 months after that, patients developed some neutropenia probably related to the fact that rituximab also wipe out some of the regulatory lymphocytes that actually maintain the neutrophil inhibitor cells, something like that. So that's actually pretty common in oncology service because they use rituximab a lot. I remember Dr. Gibson today, she mentioned most of like two doses regimen, actually pretty prevalent to practice in our nephrology field. Probably that's a good idea. And also that did bring up a question. Should we monitor the CD20 and then just to titrate the dose based on the suppression level of the CD20? And I do feel some of our patients with steroid sensitive but dependent nephrotic syndrome, some patients do have a pretty good response, especially if we don't have other good options. Obviously, you try not to use the calcineurin inhibitor for too long. But for resistant, I personally don't feel like I had a good experience. But as I remember, in adult field, they also want to give it a try. And today, all the speakers brought up a very good point. They all mentioned like circulating factor. I know recently in JASN, they published a paper about anti-nephrin antibody potentially can trigger minimal change disease. Mm-hmm. Is that one of the circulating factor that could be suppressed by rituxan? So maybe, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
And to add to that, there was a Japanese study who also looked into not only doing rituximab like two or four doses, and then also continuing rituximab every 6 months, particularly in some patients where we see after a year after stopping rituximab, their nephrotic syndrome recurs. I don't know how to differentiate patients who will recur in a year or two versus who wouldn't. So should we just use every 6 months rituximab on at least patients who had history of multiple recurrences? So any thoughts on that?
So my personal opinion, obviously it's not based on data. So I do see a successful practice just based on each patient's situation. If they have a relapse at that time, they check the CD20, everything to see if it's correlated to their population of CD20. At that time, they probably only give one dose of rituximab. At the same time, use steroid to induce the remission. I feel like that will be a pretty good risk-benefit judgment, because rituximab, overall, it's an antibody, have reported long-term complication like lymphoma. So yeah. That makes me nervous about dosing that regularly. But however, if it is like ANCA vasculitis, you have very good rationale to do that.
Yeah.
That's just my opinion.
Well, yeah, we'll do that differently. So one of the things that drives me crazy is how much we have to rely on expert opinion to treat nephrotic syndrome. I mean, let alone everything else that we do in nephrology, but it drives me crazy that we've just been unable, for many good reasons, to come together and ask and answer a really good research question that's very clearly defined, including in the realm of comparative effectiveness. So we've made incremental steps recently, mainly having to extrapolate from adult data, but I hope in our respective lifetime and our careers that we can make substantial progress in that, and so that we can stop relying on expert opinion and emails back and forth, which is definitely helpful, but to a point, and really be able to trust good data to really benefit our patients.
Well, you know what they say. When you're in med school, you read the books. When you're in residency, you follow the guidelines. And when you're in fellowship, you just do what your mentors do. So yeah. We never have actually gone beyond that to, you know, doing something like what you were saying, Andrew. So I think that's a great thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, I do research now, so I just ask the question. I don't have to do the other stuff. I just ask the question.
Okay. Asking the question is very, very important.
So our second session of the day was the session on JEDI, which is a great name, by the way.
Yes. I did not come up with it, but I also agree. It's amazing. Yeah.
So first question is, what were some key takeaway points from this session?
So I think that it was really meaningful to have a pediatric nephrologist, Pat Brophy, open the entire meeting with a welcome to the entire PAS, and then have Ray Bignall, another pediatric nephrologist, give an amazing keynote speech, not about nephrology, but just about racism and how it affects patients, contributing to research studies. And I just The fact that we in peds nephrology are already leading in this area, which we know has acquired a lot of additional attention in the last couple of years, made me really proud. And so this session was not a surprise that the program chairs decided to have this session. There were four amazing speakers. Dr. Kia Sanderson spoke about social determinants of health and really did an amazing job of characterizing all of the data that's out there that shows how all these factors impact healthcare outcomes. You know, I guess it's not surprising nephrologists, we like data and details, but also can really connect it to a big picture mentality. So I think this is the perfect subject to be able to review the data, show us what studies are there, show us the deficits in research done in this area, and then inspire us to make changes. The second speaker, also amazing review of the data on how racism impacts health. That was Marciana Laster from UCLA. And I think that she really, in a very convincing manner, showed us how racism has long-lasting effects on morbidity and mortality, especially in our patients. Dr. Hayde's talk about sort of where we are, who we are, who goes into medical school, what are the factors that affect our decisions to go into which specialties was very fascinating to me. I think that we need to think more about that. It's not surprising that race and money and power and systemic structures affect who goes to medical school, who chooses what specialty. And I think it was really well done how she highlighted all the data. And then Dr. Issa Ashour, I think, had the hardest job, which was to sort of give us a roadmap of what are we going to do next. But he, again, pulled a lot of really interesting data about sources of support, how we can dismantle some of the issues that are at hand. And I appreciated that he really acknowledged how much work we all have to do in peds nephrology, both for our patients and to, you know, inspire our next generation of colleagues. And hopefully to inspire the ones who are going to reflect the diversity of our patients. So there are just so many takeaways. I could just go on and on about it, but it was just a really powerful session, I thought, with really great speakers. And I have to say, it's always really gratifying to look out into the, audience and see leaders in our field, like learning and asking questions, and being very humbling in terms of, you know, these people that we really admire don't have all the answers. And I think that's the beauty of peds nephrology. Like, we're always trying to answer the questions and maybe now formulating different questions. I think one of my favorite questions was about research design and clumping different ethnic groups together. And I happen to be Asian. And so, like, all those studies that say all the Asians, you know, all the Asians, and we know how Asians can be very heterogeneous, like the ones sitting at this table, we can all relate to it. Yeah, exactly. And I think that that goes to, you know, people like Dr. Seth, who are going to design the research studies. Like, how do you define the patient demographics? Maybe the patients should define their own demographics. Maybe they should be determined by what language they speak or what zip code they live in. So Oh, you have a question. Oh, yeah. So, I would love to hear everybody's thoughts about this. I'm not a researcher. I take care of patients, but I do a lot of teaching and mentoring, and I'm debating whether I should just open up a daycare center for children so I can make them peds nephrologists, but anyway.
Right. We may have to come to that.
Yeah, I really feel like we have to start very early. Yeah.
Go ahead, Andrew.
Great. Yeah, I wanted to extend that thought in the question that was asked in the session, and in terms of research, it's not just how do we ask the question, who do we ask, but what are we going to do with that information? Like, how are we conceptualizing that variable? And is what we act it to be actually what we intend it to be? So that's a classic example of how we, and I count myself in this because I did it wrong for years, what do we actually mean by race when we collect that variable? And be very intentional about beforehand, before we even collect that data, what do I want this to mean? And as I ask it, in the manner in which you ask, whom you ask, is that going to be an adequate representation of what I intend it to be? So I think in moving this field forward, we have to ask the right people how to do that. And so that's just for an example of something I'm doing. I'm trying to learn because I have no idea, but I want to know. I want to learn from people who are much smarter than me. So I think our field is really coming together nicely in that regard, and people who have the power are taking that step back and wanting to know how to do it better. Mm-hmm. That's been really encouraging to see in a short amount of time.
So I went and attended the Jedi session as well, and I'm sort of putting two different thoughts in together in my head that maybe you can speak about. So the second speaker presented information about preterm birth and Black women and how that actually got worse as the education level went up. And that made me think of a statement that was made by Dr. Shaquita Bell yesterday, the second keynote speaker, who said, of course, race is a social construct. And she said that race is not a risk factor, but racism is a risk factor. And when that, I heard that information about that increased education level and worsening preterm birth, I couldn't help but kind of merge those two ideas in my brain and think that maybe that's what was going on, which is unfortunate. Yeah. But
I mean, it certainly makes me think, especially as a person who works with trainees, to think about the experience of an underrepresented trainee, what they may have experienced as a child, as a medical student, as a resident. And I think that we, as more experienced people in the field, really need to be cognizant of that and how that affects the people in our field as well as our patients. I found that to be equally disturbing. And, you know, Serena Williams came to mind, the example of, you know, the wealthiest, most talented elite athlete who still had was the victim of racism and how it impacted her health. And so we have a long way to go. But I think it is very refreshing to have all this data presented at a national meeting so that we can all be aware of it and think about how we can intervene.
One of the takeaway points for me was when Marciana Laster said, there was a line in her slide that said, it is not what is wrong with them, but what has happened to them. So I think that's something that I'm going to keep in my head and frame all of my patient care around from now on. That was a great point that she made.
And I think Dr. Sanderson's talk about social determinants of health, which also has been the subject of other talks like the nutrition talk and talking about food insecurity, I think that we are getting better at asking those questions once we have solutions for our patients. Because I think we can all agree we don't want to ask a question and not have a solution for their answer. So it's another, I think, refreshing thing that I've heard at this meeting in a lot of different contexts, like even at the transplant session, the screening about adherence. Like, there's so many great things happening in our field about how we can, you know, think about the mechanism of our patient's nephrotic syndrome, but also wonder, do they have a safe place to sleep at night? Like, that's what's great about our field, that we have the ability to think about both of those things. So I was very hopeful, I would say, after the end of this session. I think there's so much interesting work happening. And unlike, I think, a lot of fields or I would say there was a lot of posturing, like in 2020, that people were, you know, making statements about how important it is to discuss racism. But I think that I see it really happening in peds nephrology. I feel like we're going to keep this momentum going.
Well, there's hope for the future, right? And it all starts here. So that's wonderful. We had lots of other exciting sessions, too, at ASPN today.
So next, we'll talk about hypertension. We talk about hypertension all the time. And we have Andrew South here, who chaired the session. So Andrew, what are your initial thoughts about this session? What did we learn new today?
Thank you. Yeah, so it was a fascinating session, and we had an amazing panel of experts in the field, all of whom I look up to. So it's always an honor to be involved and just get to be a fly on the wall and listen to them and their wisdom. It was a really nice progression of topics that on the surface appeared to be a little bit separate, but the speakers did a great job of weaving in a nice narrative. Dr. Don Patisky did a wonderful job of talking about social determinants of health and climate change, which on the surface, like, how do those two things fit in together? But it was a great macro view of how all of these different aspects of our patients and their lives interplay to impact, oftentimes adversely, their cardiovascular health, for example. So I think Dr. Patisky did a great job of painting that picture and moving into how we think about conceptualize target organ damage in youth with hypertension. So going into the next talk, Dr. Carissa Baker-Smith did a great job summarizing where we are in the field about how you assess cardiac target organ damage, like left ventricular hypertrophy, and segueing into thinking in the future, how can we better target treatment to decrease that intermediate cardiovascular risk factor and reduce left ventricular hypertrophy in terms of target blood pressure thresholds. Showed some great data from recent SHIP AHOY study analyses and moving the field forward. And Dr. Baker-Smith has a huge role nationally with American Heart Association as a pediatric cardiologist to really advocate for funding agencies and advocacy groups to help people pay attention to this important topic. So that was really cool. And then Dr. Joseph Flynn, moving on to whether or not this actually exists, of kidney damage as target organ damage in youth with hypertension. And I think he did a great job of going a little bit off book in a creative way to conceptualize it as we need to talk about primary hypertension, which is distinctly separate from secondary hypertension, which is almost always or the majority being chronic kidney disease associated hypertension. And that's a really important distinction conceptually to make when we think about chicken versus egg. So did the subclinical kidney damage come first or did the hypertension come first? And that's really important both clinically and as we frame our research questions. And then finally, Dr. Elaine Urbina did a great job and showed some new SHIP AHOY study data that was not published yet, so that was fun to get a sneak peek, again, about target organ damage and more novel methods that hopefully in the not-too-distant future will become standard of clinical care. So she predominantly focused on pulse wave velocity as a measure of arterial stiffness and talked about augmentation index, which was great because I always learn from her in that topic as I do my own research. So I just be quiet and I listen and think about the vasculature. And then she talked about carotid intima medial thickness. And finally, something that we do less often even in researchers is flow-mediated dilation. So really trying to understand how the vasculature works in youth with hypertension and how that can inform our ability to define cardiovascular phenotypes to figure out who among those patients are most at risk for having sustained hypertension and actually having an increased risk of cardiovascular disease as young adults and older adults. So it was a really nice conceptualization of that topic and starting to think about where we can go forward. And hopefully that will, if I had my druthers, that will become standard of care clinically. So that was a really cool session to be a part of.
Thank you, Andrew. So I did attend this session, and it was interesting to see like how the both climate change as well as social determinants affect pediatric patients with hypertension. So what can we do as a group to at least like I don't think we'll be able to stop it completely, at least to address from our standpoint.
I wanted to ask Dr. Patiski that question, but we got a lot of questions in the Q&A session, so I didn't get a chance to. But from my own personal experience, it's how do we as providers change our thinking? Like, we can't change our practice and change how we do research until we change how we think about stuff. So tearing down our assumptions and getting away from just our standard procedure of you go see the patient, you ask the standard set of questions. So how do we incorporate this new language, because that's what it is, into everything that we do? And so for me, in my mind, I call it protocolization. And so how do I take this new information and turn it into my routine care? And this was eye-opening for me in terms of a personal example for social determinants of health and unmet social needs. I was fortunate enough to be involved with a study a couple years ago that we published in Pediatric Nephrology with two colleagues at Wake Forest who are much smarter than me, Deepak Palakshpan and Callie Brown, both are here at PAS. I'm shocked to say this still, I had never heard of social determinants of health. And this was in 2018. So I was already on faculty for 3 years. I just completely, and it's on me, I just head down, did not even know the concept. And so it was enlightening for me to hear about it and how important it is from experts in the field. And so we were just having coffee and we're all young investigators. And I said, well, is there a link with blood pressure? And we did a study with NHANES and found an association with high blood pressure and food insecurity in youth. And it just changed my practice. So almost right away, it's now been like routine screening in our clinic to ask about food insecurity with the two-item screen for the AAP recommendations and for me, it took learning. I just had to be hit over the head with it and understand why it's important by talking to people who know and that are much smarter than me. And then being able to be like, recognize that how important it is, again, by being humble and learning about those things, and then figuring out that creative way to consistently do it in practice. And I'm not perfect. I probably do it 80% of the time. I'm trying to get better. And it's been really fun to teach our trainees, the residents, the med students, the fellows, most of whom know more about it than me, about why we're doing it in clinic. And I've had a handful of times where families ask, why'd you ask that question? And I had a patient recently who their father asked about it, and he's in the social work sphere, and so he knows firsthand why we asked that question. He just wanted to know my thoughts on it. And so that was a really cool point of connection with that patient.
I think, you know, in the realm of not going back to my session, but bias, and when you ask certain questions to some patients and not others, one way to eliminate bias is to just consistently ask the same questions to everyone. And what I love about the food insecurity screening is you can present that as part of a panel of nutritional questions and ask everybody. And I have pediatricians in my community who have done this in their clinics and have found that many of the patients who are food insecure are not the ones that they might have suspected. So I love that idea that it just changes your daily practice. You kind of normalize it in your patient interactions, and it just becomes part of your routine almost to integrate. So I think that's fantastic.
One thing I learned in pandemic is we talk so much about like hypertension clinics, low salt, more fruits and vegetables. And one grandmother opened up to me and said, Doc, I have like, with particularly in the pandemic, I got so many food coupons, so I bought a lot of canned goods. Do you think I need to throw that away? Mm. I'm like, no, please do not throw that away. I told, rinse it twice and add extra vegetables to it and don't add any more salt. She said, I never thought about this. I came that up with that thought out of blue. I'm like, just because she asked, I never thought about this. So it's important. Like our patients, many of our patients have limited resources. So if we can, we should help how to use that resources. If not, seek a social worker and dietitian's help. But do not ask them to know you cannot do that is not an answer, because we are not living their lives. That's what I learned that day, which I felt, oh my goodness, I never thought about this.
Yeah. I'll just jump in with a challenge, though. I saw those two questions that I think Michelle Starr had put up there for food insecurity. And I'll say this because I trained in India, too. And it is very cultural for someone to share with you that they're struggling. Mm-hmm. So if you go to my community and you ask them that question, they may be on the streets and destitute, but would they tell a physician that they're struggling? Never. So we have to think about that too, is what is their attitude towards these questions when they're sitting in your clinic? And I think that that might be something that might give us some false results if we don't put some more intentionality into it.
Yeah. That's a great idea, and that goes to our theme about asking the right question.
Yes.
So we can't start by saying, all right, well, we're going to screen for food insecurity and we'll see if we do a social work consult, if that improves outcomes. We have to take a step back. And this is something I've thought about obsessively the past 6 months. What if we start with the question, does asking about food insecurity improve outcomes, especially if you make your primary outcome a patient-centered outcome?
Right.
To see what their feelings are about that. How does that make them feel? Going to our assumptions as clinicians. Oh, I'm asking about this important thing, so of course they're going to appreciate that. They're going to be like, oh, doctor, thank you so much for asking. Yes, I'm struggling. And that's not reality at all. And so, yes. Again, we first do no harm. We need to start with the very basics and the very beginning is incremental steps. Is what we want to do actually going to help? And looking at it in a multifaceted view rather than just our very narrow focus, which we're all good at, unfortunately. But that's been a challenge for me personally, is just to figure that out. And I don't know. I don't have the answers. Yeah. But
And exhibits why having diversity in the field, people who are already part of the field can just ask these questions and have that experience. Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, I said this last year, and I'll say this again. We cannot solve society's problems in a clinic room. So we have to partner with the community. if they come in and they see us and we focus on the science and taking care of their health, we need to have a partnership with the community so that these questions can be addressed in a more comfortable environment for them. So we cannot do this alone. That's my feeling.
Absolutely. So I have a question on the other spectrum of the food security. So I was fascinated to learn when Dr. Arbaina said that if you decrease BMI by 0.5 points, your blood pressure will go down by 6 to 7 millimeters of mercury. I was like, oh my goodness, it's like BMI 0.5%. So how can we help our obese kids?
How much time do we have left?
I was going to say, where do we start?
Okay, I am learning a lot about this because it obviously affects all of our patients. And I direct our hypertension clinic at our institution. And I've learned a lot from Dr. Joseph Skelton, who's a pediatric gastroenterologist who just focuses on obesity. He directs our Brenner Fit Families in Training program, which is a weight management metabolic health management clinic. He's a leading expert in the country and the world on this topic. So I just, again, sit down and I'd be quiet and I'd listen to him. Again, I, from learning from my own mistakes over the years, I've really moved to a place where I try my hardest, use person-centric thinking in actions and speaking. So I, and all my trainees know this, do not say obese 15-year-old. No. So 15-year-old with obesity. And then we do this in the clinic. We do this on papers. And it's a challenge I do to myself as well as everyone else I work with. We have to change our thinking, right? We're moving in that direction. There's a lot of organizations that are making that standard language now, but I still catch myself making that mistake all the time. So one of the things I've learned from Dr. Skelton and we incorporate in our hypertension clinic and the rest of our clinics, and going back to what does race mean as a variable, what are we trying to target for treatment in hypertension? It is deceptive to say, okay, if I decrease BMI by this amount, blood pressure will then go down. That's not good logic to use. That's not the right research question to ask. And so in our approach, and we are not the only ones doing this by any means, is I tell my families, I just want you to, over time, more often than not, make healthier choices about the food that you have and the activities that you can do, physical activity, under the confines and restrictions of what's available to them, which is why social determinants of health are so important. I can tell them to do the DASH diet until I'm blue in the face, but if they cannot access healthy fruits and vegetables, either they don't have the transportation or they don't have the money to do so, because unfortunately it's expensive, then it doesn't make any difference. It's like prescribing a medication and they're not adherent, but it's unintentional adherence, right? They want to do it, but they literally cannot. And so I've really, both in research and clinical practice, tried to just change my thought process and then subsequently my behaviors and how I communicate with the team and with families. And being like, let's just focus on making some of these changes. The weight, the BMI, like, that's a number I look at, but that is not our focus at all. And so when it's an age-appropriate kid, I'm like, look, you're beautiful, you're awesome. Like, obesity is a medical condition, yes, but that's not what we're focused on today at all. And so that's anecdotally been a much better approach for me, and I think we'll eventually have some data to back that up or not or disprove it. But that's been my approach and what I've been learning from people who are much smarter than me. And so that, I think, for approach to treatment in youth with obesity who have hypertension as well, really having that honest conversation with them about why this is important, but what is our actual focus? Being very intentional about that relationship, goals of care really is a good thing to come in. And that's something I'm still struggling with focusing on, but that's at least my approach so far.
So, one other thought that resonated with me very well is about what Dr. Arbaina mentioned is the kids and adults who eat more fruits and vegetables, they overall have lesser blood pressures as an adult. So I think that's what we need to more focus on. So now We are talking, we are going to talk about the transplant potpourri we have Dr. Elizabeth Spivak to give us an overview about that.
Yeah, so the title of it was Potpourri of Hot Topics in Kidney Transplant. And so we did learn about a lot of new things that are coming down the pike here. The first speaker, Dr. Margaret Box, talked about epidemiology and changes in the kidney allocation system and how that's changed recently and what's kind of coming up here soon. The second speaker was Dr. Michael Seifert, and he talked about an update on surveillance of renal transplant, and we mostly highlighted cell-free DNA as a marker of potential need for biopsy and surveillance biopsies and things like that. The third speaker was Dr. Dechu Pulyanda, and she talked a lot about kind of antibody-mediated rejection and the pathophysiology of that, and then introduced a few new treatment options, some of which I had not heard about. And then the last speaker was Dr. Olga Charnaya, and she spoke about cutting-edge therapies. So she introduced a ton of new therapies that I had never even heard of, a long list that I won't go through all of, but it was very interesting to think about some of these new things that may be coming to treat rejection, but also to be used as induction therapies as well.
So recently I have been hearing more about like cell-free DNA. Could you elaborate on that? How is it better? And do you think that could potentially replace doing donor-specific antibodies?
Yeah, so that was a big topic that Dr. Seifert talked about gave a lot of evidence for cell-free DNA as a marker, specifically in an indication to do a biopsy, because you could find some subclinical rejection when you did surveillance biopsies, but surveillance biopsies are costly for sure, and basically you're putting folks at risk that maybe didn't need it. And so doing the cell-free DNA to use as an indicator to then pursue a biopsy is very helpful. We talked a lot about the efficacy of the cell-free DNA, but it is still not widely practiced, I would say, because he even admitted himself that he doesn't necessarily use these cell-free DNA tests at his institution. I do know, as a personal side note, Naprotix is now starting to collect data on folks who are using cell-free DNA testing. Oh. So I have a feeling the evidence for or against cell-free DNA is about to just become very robust as we get all of this data from these different institutions who are going to use it and submit it to Naprotix.
So from University of Iowa, we are using cell-free DNA. And my personal experience in my transplant patients, I feel, you know, previously we decide who needs to go through biopsy, either like de novo DSA or abnormal allograft function. But actually, several of our kids, they did not have this kind of index. And the cell-free DNA did help us to actually pick up early identification of antibody-mediated rejection. So I really appreciate this test. I feel, obviously, my experience is limited in these cases, but I feel their specificity is pretty high.
Yes, yes. And that was one of the pieces of data he presented was the how helpful it is when things are positive, but also how it can be reassuring when it is negative that you don't need to pursue a biopsy in that patient. And he also did say that it's much better for predicting antibody-mediated rejection as opposed to T-cell-mediated rejection as well.
So I have been following this closely, and it's a fascinating development that I'm hopeful pans out. And I will say, I note a caution, we have to ask the right question. So what's the goal? Are we trying to avoid biopsy? Is it going to improve outcomes? So it's the same argument that we're still trying to deal with. Do surveillance biopsies actually improve graft outcomes or patient outcomes? And that's still not known. So I hope, and I think so, knowing the people that are involved, I think we're getting that way, and I think we'll be asking those questions. But that is something that I've been watching and thinking about a lot.
Yes, and that came up as a question as well, specifically in regards to cost, too. What is the cost of doing surveillance biopsies? What is the cost of doing a biopsy on a patient that you don't need it on? We're talking tens, $10,000 to $20,000, whereas, yes, a cell-free DNA test is also expensive in the realm of a couple thousand. But using creatinine, which is very cheap in relative perspective, yeah, it's super cheap, but it may delay your diagnosis. So yeah, I think those are definitely things to think about. Is it going to change? I think we try to ask ourselves that question in general, like, will this test change my management? And if not, then I shouldn't probably do it.
Cost to patients too, you know, as somebody who takes care of families living in rural South Carolina who have to travel to a transplant center for care, I think we underestimate what we ask of these families if we tell them to return to their transplant center again and again for therapies that have not had proven benefit yet. So yeah. I think that's great that we got to talk about that today.
Yes.
So, Elizabeth, could you give us a brief overview of the cutting-edge therapies?
Yes. So the one that I found the most interesting was actually introduced in the third session, but then elaborated on in the fourth session, was this IDES, I-D-E-S, which is immunoglobulin G degrading enzyme of strep pyogenes. And so this enzyme goes and cleaves the antibody and makes it inactive in the setting of antibody-mediated rejection. So then you no longer have this rejection because that antibody is now inactive. And it's made from a bacteria, which is very common. And there have been some studies on it. So Dr. Olga Charnaya mentioned this it was called the HIGHDES trial, H-I-G-H-D-E-S, I think. And they were talking about it and using that medication to convert folks who had a positive crossmatch to have a negative crossmatch before a transplant. Now, they did say that the donor-specific antibody did rebound in those patients, but I think it's very exciting that we have these new novel therapies that may change the way that we continue to treat transplant patients. And she also mentioned several other new medications and things I had heard of too, belatacept, both as an induction agent, but also as a maintenance agent. Tocilizumab, which was also mentioned in the third session as well. Lots of monoclonal antibodies, two different anti-CD40 antibodies. And then talking about, there was a CRADLE study which looked at everolimus and reduced dose Tacro, which actually showed that folks who got everolimus and the reduced dose of Tacro as opposed to MMF plus standard dose Tacro, those folks who got everolimus had a higher incidence of EBV. And so Dr. Twombly, the other chair, kind of whispered to me as that was like, do we want to take that risk with, say, you know, a 6-year-old? Do we want to be taking that risk? And so I think it's interesting to hear these new things, but to also understand that they may not all make it. There's a lot of new drugs out there, but are they all going to be useful? We don't know yet.
Okay, so let me put this final question to everybody on the panel. How has what you heard today, how is it going to change your practice? Just one thing or two things that you're going to change because you came to ASPN 22. Who wants to go first?
So I have been absolutely just floored and stuck on this racism as a risk factor thing. I am just so stuck on it and even asked, you know, the first speaker about that and how the kidney allocation system changes to this continuous distribution. How is that going to change our inequity for minoritized individuals? And so I think I'm going to take away for sure just how I think about race and how I think about my patients who are minorities. And like you said, opening a daycare for I feel like I'm going to ask every minoritized patient that I have, whether they want to be a doctor and like, just really push this because I feel very strongly, you know, that I can't relate because I am a white female, but I want so badly to relate that I'm going to do everything I can to develop, you know, that empathy and try and fight this because it is really struck a nerve with me listening to the introductory session yesterday with the keynote speakers, and I'm ready to go full force into fighting racism.
Well, I think that is great. And I think that really it's just allowing space for different voices to be heard. And I don't think that it is saying that, you know, one versus the other. It is like all of us. So, and I think that, you know, if the more we look like the patients we take care of, the more they trust us. So I think that was the takeaway for me too. But I'm going to go back and I'm going to change my templates, Andrew, so that I do not say obese patients, yes, but I will write patient with obesity from yes now on. So thank you for
let's
that
talk about that. I have the templates.
Yes, so, please.
All right.
Actually, I want to add to that. I recently wrote a paper with Andrew where we had this discussion and I changed my templates already.
Yay. One solid thing we can do.
Yep. That's great. Yes.
All right. Linda.
So I feel, you know, my background is like I do a lot of like scientific research. This time, just learning from the session that I had the honor to moderate, I feel people are starting to really look into what's the actual mechanism of a disease and use that to find out what's the actual problem of the specific patient and do personalized practice. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I start to learn more of the methods and diagnostic tools to help us to achieve that goal and pick the best medication for this individual patient. But also, Andrew mentioned data, evidence-based practice is so important to give the best benefit and minimize the risks.
That's
so those are
wonderful
a lot of things to consider, especially for like junior MDs yes like me.
Ask the right questions, right?
Exactly.
That's what I learned. Patty.
This is very hard. I was already on the path of basically telling every pediatric patient, hey, you should think about being a pediatric nephrologist. So I'm going to reinforce that behavior. I think maybe the language I use in terms of adherence and to basically delete every single problemist that says non-compliant or poor compliance and think about barriers to adherence. I really like that thought process better because it it's more of a problem-solving mentality. And I think the other piece of that is asking patients what their goals are, whether it's an obese, a child with obesity who has hypertension, see, I'm learning, or somebody with nephrotic syndrome who is going under induction therapy and, you know, is a teenage girl and maybe will be on steroids for 8 to 12 weeks. I think that really engaging your patient and thinking about what their goals are needs to continue to be an intentional part of practice. So that's what I'm going to work on.
All right. And we're going to end with Andrew, who has been the sole male pediatric nephrology representative on today's panel. Thank you for that. And I'm just going to first say a joke that Dave made yesterday. And he said, there are no manuals in our conference this year. And he made sure there weren't any flannels either. So don't ask me what a flannel is, but we came close today. So thank you for saving us. Go ahead.
My biggest takeaway is I'm going to rise to Dr. Batiski's challenge. And I'm going to start talking to my patients about how climate change can affect their cardiovascular health. And maybe, just maybe, it's a way that we can influence the general population as physicians to help affect positive change towards combating climate change.
That's a wonderful thought. And with that, I think we're going to wrap up our episode of The Sediment. Thank you all for coming and your valuable time at the conference. I hope you all get to do something fun right after this. And we will see you tomorrow for another day of programming from ASPN.